Welcome to Reading the Sioux City Journal for Monday, June 28th. I'm Ross, and I am a volunteer for Iowa Radio Reading Service. I'll start with front page news. There is one short, brief obituary that I will read at half past the hour. We'll start with the media editorial, which is from today's journal editorial board. It says, "Here's hoping for more rain soon as the area suffers from drought conditions. Several days of good soaking rains would make a big difference for local farmers who rely on timely moisture." Again, that's by the Journal Editorial Board. From inside on the talk page, today's online poll question is, what is the best job in baseball? Yesterday's poll question was, what would you take if you had to evacuate in a flood? They had 19 votes. 42% said pets, 21% said photographs, and 37% said other. Today's one local news story on the front page is by Dolly Butts. The headline says, "Developers seek help on housing shortage. Council to consider tax credit applications." Two Sioux City developers are seeking financial assistance to help address the shortage of housing for new workers. Rick Bertrand of Bertrand Construction, LLC, and David Hegarty of Roy Dave, LLC, are asking the Sioux City Council to support their submissions of Iowa Economic Development Authority applications for the Workforce Housing Tax Credit Program. The council is slated to vote on the matter on Monday. The goal of the WHTC program is to spur new housing growth that will help address the state's pending workforce shortage. The program provides a transferable investment tax credit of up to $15,000 per unit, as well as a refund of sales and use tax paid on the project up to $1 million per project. Bertrand Construction plans to submit an application for funding to assist with the construction of a 14 single-family homes on Addison Circle near the 2800 block of Floyd Boulevard on the city's north side. Bertrand Construction plans to invest $2.8 million in the project and is applying to the WHTC program for a combined total of $350,000 in investment tax credits and sales tax refunds. Roy Dave is applying for funding to build 18 residential townhouse units near 1501 334th Street, which is also on the city's north side. Roy Dave plans to invest roughly $3.6 million in the project and is applying to the WHTC program for a combined $480,000 in investment tax credits and sales tax refunds. According to documents filed with the city, a local match for these projects will be provided through the citywide urban revitalization program. Jumping inside to the local page, there's a story by the Journal staff headlined, "Man, Woman Arrested After Shots Fired Incident and a Pursuit." Two Milwaukee residents were arrested Sunday after a shots fired incident on Grandview Boulevard and a subsequent police chase. At around 2:38 p.m. Sunday, the Sioux City Police Department received a shots fired report from the 1800 block of Grandview Boulevard, according to a press release from the department. Responding officers found an unoccupied van that had been shot multiple times. No one was injured in the shooting. The owner of the van told officers that her estranged common-law husband had been there wanting the keys to the van, which she refused to give him. Witnesses provided a description of the suspect vehicle, a white Ford Explorer. Shortly thereafter, law enforcement officers in South Dakota located the suspect car and pursued it after it had fled a traffic stop. Multiple law enforcement agencies, including the North Sioux City Police Department, the Elk Point Police Department, the Union County Sheriff's Office, and the South Dakota Highway Patrol, were involved in the pursuit, which ended only after tire deflation devices were deployed. Anwar Maxwell, 41, of Milwaukee, and Tiana Maxey, also of Milwaukee, were taken into custody. Maxey faces traffic charges related to the pursuit and was booked into the Union County Jail. Maxwell was brought to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center for medical treatment after the South Dakota Highway Patrol used non-lethal rounds to subdue him and for an unknown medical complaint, according to the press release. Maxwell was subsequently booked into the Woodbury County Jail on charges including felon in possession of a firearm, possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver, drug tax stamp violation, reckless use of a firearm, criminal mischief, and a warrant from Wisconsin. There is also an Associated Press story out of South Dakota on the local page. The headline says, Flandreau Santee Sioux to open medical cannabis dispensary. South Dakota's first medical marijuana dispensary is set to open in Flandreau. The Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe announced Friday that it will open its first retail location and begin selling cannabis Thursday, the day medical marijuana becomes legal in South Dakota. The tribe said it's already accepting applications for medical marijuana ID cards, the Sioux Falls Argus Leader reported. The tribe's program is independent of South Dakota's new law and the system that the South Dakota Department of Health has until October to launch. The state is also awaiting a Supreme Court decision on whether recreational marijuana will become legal under a constitutional amendment approved by voters in November. The Native Nations cannabis dispensary is about 45 miles north of Sioux Falls. To qualify through the tribe, an applicant must first be certified by a medical professional to have a, quote, chronic or debilitating disease or medical condition. Patients who might benefit from cannabis, such as those with AIDS, anorexia, arthritis, cancer, migraines, and glaucoma, are eligible with a recommendation from anyone licensed to prescribe drugs. Applications are on the tribe's website. The fee is $50. The tribe's news release said the tribe's goals for the development of cannabis is similar to other jurisdictions. It wants a safe product to produce revenue for tribal programs, to curtail black market sales of cannabis, and to prevent illegal diversion, especially to children. And just another short brief from page 2, Onawa boil water advisory has been lifted. A boil water advisory in Iowa has been lifted, the Monona County Sheriff's Office reported in a social media post Sunday. The city had issued a boil water advisory Friday morning as the city tested its water as a precautionary measure. It was initially scheduled to remain in effect until Monday. Two consecutive sets of water samples showed no bacteria present, according to an Iowa Department of Natural Resources press release. City Water Plant Supervisor Eric Messenbrink said a thunderstorm Thursday morning caused an electrical short, which led to an equipment failure at the water plant. That resulted in low water pressure, which can cause bacteria to enter the water distribution system and triggered the boil advisory until tests confirmed the city's water supply is not contaminated. There is a rather lengthy story on the state page. It's from the Mason City Globe Gazette's Jared McNett, and the headline says, Californian has claims of holding Music Man history. And I will tell you, this has an odd beginning, so bear with the story and it will eventually get to the main point. In 1967, Robert T. DeNormandy Jr. performed as a guest musician with the Robin Hood Marching Band of Hollywood for that year's iteration of the Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena, which featured Thai Minister of Foreign Affairs Tonet Komen as the Grand Marshal. The game pitted hometown USC Trojans against the Purdue Boilermakers, who won the Rose Bowl 14-13, courtesy of two rushing touchdowns from fullback Perry Williams. The Piatone Vedette newspaper of Illinois reported that DeNormandy, who grew up in the Chicago suburbs, was a junior at local Evergreen Park High School and had already received a number of musical honors and awards to that point in his life. The article also says, Bob spent the past 4 years at the Illinois Youth Summer Music Camp at Urbana and 3 years with the national stage bands at Bloomington, Indiana. He has won superior ratings in state solo contests and is a first chair baritone player with the Southwest Suburban Festival Concert. 54 years and 800 miles later, California resident De Normandy arrived in Mason City, betting that all of that musical knowledge and experience would pay off, but it hasn't, not yet. Earlier this month, De Normandy blew into town in his 1995 Ford Explorer with 139,000 miles on it from Yuba City, California, telling the story of that Rose Bowl experience, as well as the origins of a double bell euphonium his father gave him in 1964 that he considers one of his most prized possessions. De Normandy says, "For the last three or four decades, I've been researching from where the instrument was created, from the manufacturer, and trying to find the backstory of what was conveyed to me as a child, that there were six of these horns made for Meredith Wilson's movie, The Music Man. Inscribed on the bell, you'll read that. It says so." De Normandy then said, given the time period it was first acquired, he doesn't have any paperwork on the item. His father is no longer alive, so his only certification is the story he has and the euphonium itself, which features the inscription made by RMC for the filming of Meredith Wilson's The Music Man by Warner Brothers and is imprinted with the serial number 61064. The former marching band player said what brought him to town was that after a period of reaching out to people online to try and find a home for the potentially historic film instrument, he got a Google alert for the Music Man Square in Mason City. So De Normandy said that he talked with an official representing the Music Man Square and offered the euphonium for $11,000, the price he previously had on it on the internet. Parentheses, it says, on October 18, 2020, De Normandy posted the euphonium as being for sale on a public Facebook group page called Double Bell Euphoniums. De Normandy's post said, "Music Man movie only, six contact seller, Music Man movie only, six custom made, 1962, original owner since 1962. That's all in parentheses. Per De Normandy, an agent for the Music Man Square told him they had the ways and means to raise the funds to cover that cost. And then De Normandy says, that's great. So I'm really feeling anxious and excited and thinking, wow, what a great idea. This could be exhibited in a museum. My baby is going to come home where it belongs. I'm getting psyched up for myself," De Normandy said. From there, he said a private investor in the Music Man Square got involved. That person would work in conjunction with the board of directors to help pay for the euphonium and then donate it on exhibit, which the investor later confirmed with the Globe Gazette. The investor says that was the intent from day one. At a certain point, the serial number on the euphonium became a sticking point. De Normandy insists that the proper way to read the serial number on a Reynolds piece such as his, 61064, is that the first two digits represent the year. The following digits then indicate the production number. That matters because if the 61 does not indicate the year 1961, then the timeline of the instrument could fit with when the movie The Music Man was released in 1962. He said folks from the Music Man Square saw the issue of the serial number differently. Nick Whitehurst from the organization confirmed that. And then Whitehurst says, "The information we had been able to find with comparing the serial number provided and the maker, the horn itself would have been dated after the movie was produced." According to Whitehurst, the numbering issue raised a flag, as did the lack of documentation for the instrument, and the ultimate inability to verify whether or not the euphonium was in fact a screen-used piece from The Music Man. Whitehurst said, "Without having proper documentation, we weren't able to confirm it, and with the information we were able to find, the manufacturers didn't line up." Someone who does such verification weighed in on the matter, but Whitehurst chose not to disclose who that person was or what their credentials were. When asked why, Whitehurst said, "I would not want to cause more of a stir than there already is." With that information, Whitehurst said, "The Music Man Square decided to not go through with the deal. The private investor also dropped out." De Normandy said he felt, quote, "blindsided by that decision." And then De Normandy adds, I feel damaged. I feel my integrity has been questioned, and I feel like I've been called a liar, and that, I feel, needs to be soothed. I need to talk with this individual so he can personally see the horn. He can personally see the serial number. A lot of companies did their serial numbers sequentially. The 61 and 64 don't mean anything as far as date. It doesn't reflect anything with date. Deborah Reeves said she's a curator of education at the National Music Museum in Vermilion. According to her, the best approach is to try to confirm a number from a serial number list. The website, ContemporaCorner.com, contains a host of serial numbers and engraving information on instruments such as the trumpet, the flugelhorn, and the euphonium. On a page for Reynolds serial numbers, there is a list that runs from 1936 through July of 1979, when production ceased. In the entry for 1961, it's noted that, quote, most instruments between SN 60,000 and 79,000 bear the RMC shield, corresponding to the 1961 to 63 period that Richards Music owned Reynolds. The F.A. Reynolds Company became a wholly owned subsidiary of the newly formed Richards Music Corporation in 1961, according to the website. There is then a quote from the Contemporary Corner describing Reynolds' history. It says, as a division of Richards Music, Reynolds became part of the Round Table of Music Craftsmen, RMC, along with the Martin Band Instrument Company, E.K. Blessing, and Flat Jacks Drums. Instruments produced by these companies during the Richards era all bear a RMC Shield logo. In 1962, Contemporary Corner notes that Richards Music also sponsored the Music Man Contest for individual musicians between ages 8 and 18, with national, regional, and local award winners. Music Man branded Emperor trumpets, cornets, and trombones were produced in conjunction with that contest. While there isn't a shield in the literal sense on De Normandy's instrument, there is a signature for Reynolds and an RMC and the serial number on his instrument. Merlin Grady, who has done instrument repair work in Waterloo for decades, wrote in an email, "The euphonium looks legit, especially with the engraving." Over the phone, when asked about the engraving on De Normandy's instrument not being a carbon copy of other engravings for Reynolds' instruments, Grady said it wasn't uncommon for instrument manufacturers to do engravings by free hand. And then he also says, Kahn had an in-house engraver, and I'm presuming that's the way with all the old ones. The author of the Reynolds serial numbers page on the Contempora website does take care to note, quote, I am not aware of any surviving official serial number records for Reynolds brass instruments. Reeves also pointed out that serial number lists are terribly inaccurate and that serial numbers are a guarded secret as far as a company is concerned. Margaret Banks, Reeves's colleague and associate director, senior curator of musical instruments at the National Music Museum, was more direct in her assessment of De Normandy's euphonium after seeing photos of it. And she says, in my opinion, this double bell euphonium was most likely one of the instruments used in the filming of The Music Man, she wrote in an email. Her reasoning, the National Music Museum has a flute, NMM 10104, from the film engraved with Made by RMC for the filming of Meredith Wilson's The Music Man by Warner Brothers. Banks said when museum officials conducted research on the flute, they found 211 instruments were provided by RMC's subsidiaries for use in the movie, which was produced in 1961 and released in 1962. Banks then says, the manufacturer of our flute, likely made in 1960, is attributed to the Martin Brand Instrument Company, a subsidiary of RMC, and subcontractor for the Peddler Company, Elkhart, Indiana. Loris Schissel, who is from New Hampton and works as a senior musicologist for the Library of Congress, was less definitive about the euphonium. She said, According to some of my euphonium friends, 6 double bell euphoniums were made for the filming of The Music Man. I suppose this could be one of them. Beyond the matter of the serial number for De Normandie's euphonium, the asking price and when he wanted the deal done became complicating factors. Whitehurst said, "We had asked why or how the $11,000 price tag was arrived at, and the gentleman had told us that that was confidential. The private investors spoke to the pacing. Some of what raised flags for Music Man Square investors was the need for expediency. Outside the realm of music, a search for Robert De Normandie Jr. on Google turns up a fraud case where a Robert T. De Normandie, then age 66, received 5 years probation in 2016 for forgery of a $356,000 check. Per the Marysville Appeal Democrat newspaper, which covers the counties of Sutter and Yuba near Sacramento, De Normandie entered a U.S. bank and deposited the check into the account of his business, De Normandie Consulting. Multiple posts on De Normandie's Facebook reference Yuba City as recently as 2021. The Appeal Democrat article includes an explanation from De Normandie about why things unfolded the way they did. The reporter for the newspaper says, De Normandie, according to the probation report, claimed he needed money to pay a ransom for his girlfriend who had been kidnapped in the Philippines. Through Friday afternoon, De Normandie had not responded to follow-up requests via email, Facebook Messenger, and phone calls to chat. Though there are continued posts to his Facebook page with aphorisms such as, "Here today, looking forward," there's no indication as of yet whether De Normandie remains in the Midwest or whether he's made it to Florida, where he said he wanted to relocate to after he gets a deal done on the euphonium, which travels with him in the Ford Explorer, along with a number of other personal effects. So for now, it seems he hasn't made it to his intended home, neither has the instrument. Jumping back to the front page, there is a feature story on a young man, an East High School May graduate named Cale McWilliams. The headline says, "Different kind of classroom, career academy internship leads to job for East High grad." There is a photo of McWilliams, and it says in the caption that he found a full-time job at a time when his classmates are still pondering their future plans. This story is by Earl Horlick. Cale McWilliams doesn't like traditional classrooms. Instead, the May 2021 East High School graduate prefers working with his hands. This willingness for hands-on learning proved to be beneficial, since McWilliams was offered full-time employment while many of his classmates were still pondering their post-high school lives. McWilliams accepted the job of prefabricator for Thomson Electric following a semester-long internship with the Sioux City business. As part of the Sioux City Community School District's Career Academy, McWilliams previously enrolled in a Western Iowa Tech Community College electrician course. That way, he could apply classroom study with on-the-job training. Thomson Electrical Construction President Barney Potterbaum said such job training programs are a win for students, but they're also a win for local employers. Potterbaum said, "There are plenty of kids who don't know what to do after school, and the program gives kids one more choice to consider. Employers like the program because it provides an engaged workforce of young people." According to Career Academy principal Katie Towler, the school district partners with several area businesses while offering a variety of internships. Towler said, "Our aim is to allow students to experience a career path that interests them. An internship in a particular field may be a perfect fit for the student, and that's fine, or it may turn out to be something that gives them second thoughts. Finding out a career pathway isn't the right fit saves our students both time and money down the road." After discussing the internship program with McWilliams, teacher Anthony Gall discovered his student had a mind for mechanics. Gall said, "I knew Cale had the ambition and a strong work ethic. Becoming a prefabricator turned out to be something that Cale really wanted to do." Thompson Electric prefabrication manager Corey Floyd nodded his head in agreement. Floyd said, "During the school semester, I worked out a schedule that fit with Kale's school schedule. Kale would come to the shop and learn through experience what a prefabricator does." Floyd said, "This isn't a new effort by Thompson Electric." Floyd said, "Each semester for the past few years, we've brought on one or two high school students to learn a new trade," he said, noting that such internships are offered for other area school districts in addition to Sioux City. Floyd then said, "There are more electricians who are nearing retirement than there are ones entering the workforce. This helps us to bring in the next generation of electrical workers. That becomes more important in the current job market, where many industries are experiencing difficulties finding workers." Potterbaum said, "Many of our interns aren't ready for college or they want some hands-on experience before continuing school. We want them to realize that the electrical field is one that offers plenty of career advancement," which is exactly what McWilliams wanted for himself. He said, "I don't want to do the same thing over and over again. As a prefabricator, every day will be different at this job. That is what I was looking for all along." I have a few minutes before I reach 30 minutes when I will read the obituary. So one AP story that updates some of the COVID news. The headline says, "As vaccinations lag, U.S. targets the movable middle." Thrown off stride to reach its COVID-19 vaccination goal, the Biden administration is sending A-list officials across the country, devising ads for niche markets, and enlisting community organizers to persuade unvaccinated people to get a shot. The strategy has the trappings of a political campaign, complete with data crunching to identify groups that can be won over. But the message is about the public health, not ideology. The focus is a group health official's term, the movable middle. Some 55 million unvaccinated adults seen as persuadable, many of them under 30. Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra said, "We're not just going to do the mass vaccination sites. It's door-to-door. It's mobile clinics. We're doing vaccinations at churches, the PTA meeting, the barbershop, the grocery store." Officials have seized on a compelling new talking point, courtesy of the coronavirus. The potent Delta variant that has ravaged India is spreading here, now accounting for about 1 in 5 virus samples genetically coded in the U.S., the more transmissible mutation has gained a foothold in Mountain West and Heartland states. Many of those infected are young and unvaccinated. The White House has lent its top names to the vaccine push. President Joe Biden visited a mobile vaccination site in Raleigh, North Carolina on Thursday. Earlier in the day, First Lady Jill Biden held the hand of a woman at a drive-through vaccination site in Kissimmee, Florida. Doug Emhoff, the husband of Vice President Kamala Harris, has racked up thousands of frequent flyer miles, visiting at least 18 or 19 states by his count. The administration also has recruited celebrities and athletes, including country music star Brad Paisley and the Tampa Bay Lightning hockey team. Vaccination rates have dropped below 1 million a day. The administration has acknowledged that it will fall short of its goal of having 70% of adults vaccinated by July 4th. This will be about a minute early. I hope that doesn't mess people up too much. But the obituary for today is for Jerry R. Carrot of Onawa, Iowa. He was 85. Jerry Carrot died Thursday, June 24th, 2021, and the services will be June 29th at 10 a.m. at Rush Family Chapel in Onawa, Iowa. Burial will be in Kennebec Cemetery in Castaigna, Iowa, with military rites. Visitation for Jerry Carrot will be June 28th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the funeral home. I'm going to go now to another AP story, Associated Press story. This is relates to the Miami condominium collapse. It's a question and answer. The headline says, "How teams are searching for survivors. Rescuers use a variety of technology to help." Search teams have been using drones, sonar, highly sensitive microphones, and a range of other new and established technologies to help search for people in the Oceanside condominium building near Miami that collapsed into a smoldering pile of rubble. Will any of it help? Dozens of people were still unaccounted for amid fears that the death toll of at least 9 could go much higher. And then it has a series of questions here. The first is, what technologies are useful in such collapses? The most common time-tested technologies used to try to locate survivors in rubble are acoustic detection and sniffer dogs. Aerial drones equipped with cameras and other sensors can be useful to get a close look at the collapse, especially in the earliest stages of a search to help rescuers know where it's safe to enter. Data from smartphones and telecommunications carriers can show if a missing person was in the area. Joanna Gaia, a professor of management science and systems at the University of Buffalo, said it's common for search teams to use radar and microwave signals that bounce off objects and can identify people and objects. She said it's similar to the technology in cars that beeps when you're close to hitting something backing up. That can be more useful than cell phone data, which isn't as exact, especially when speed is of the essence. In a disaster situation, data is only useful if it can be interpreted quickly. Gaia said, responders are operating on a speed rather than accuracy standpoint. They think, if I think a body is there, I don't care how accurate the signal is, I'm just going to try to go save them. The next question is, what are Miami rescuers using now? The crews, which includes some 130 firefighters working in teams, are approaching the pile from above and below as they search for any signs of life in what had been a wing of the Champlain Towers South in Surfside, Florida. They said they are using sonar cameras and sensitive microphones. Neighboring communities have shared their drones, and at least one company is shipping a ground robot from California to help with the search as crews work through a tunnel underneath the building. David Prohl, a vice president of unmanned systems at Teledyne, a defense contractor that specializes in thermal sensing, he says once you get into that subterranean realm, ground robotics become incredibly useful. It can safely go where humans cannot. The next question is, will dogs help the search? Search and rescue operations use two types of dogs on disaster scenes, both trained to detect human scent, said Mark Nouveau, a former FEMA presidential appointee and disaster expert. First, there are dogs trained to pick up the scent of live bodies, but as the operation shifts to a recovery operation, cadaver-sniffing dogs take the field. Chemical tracing devices are being developed that also pick up on scents that humans can't detect, but these haven't replaced dogs yet. These are portable labs that can analyze chemical traces and gas. They use sensors to detect moisture, carbon dioxide, or any chemicals emitted through breathing, like acetone or ammonia, said the University of Buffalo's Gaia. It's almost like a mechanical sniffing dog that can't be trained or can be trained to smell things we can't. The final question is, what other technologies could prove useful? Drones and ground robots are already used in search operations, but the most sophisticated machines are still expensive, hard to come by, and rarely as fast as the skilled human rescuers controlling them. That could change as they become smarter, more nimble, and a standard part of search and rescue operations. Kroll said it will be part of the kit that first responders have. The operation of those drones and robots will be progressively more autonomous. They will be much more independent and operate as teammates rather than tools. Another technology available to the responders, but not on the scene Friday, is a Doppler radar device developed by NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and the Department of Homeland Security, which sees through concrete slabs, detecting the signatures of human respiration and heartbeats. A prototype saved 4 lives after the 2015 earthquake in Nepal, and it was used two years later in Mexico City. Its developers say it provides an edge over acoustics, the usual method for detecting people in rubble, because disaster sites tend to be noisy. Adrian Garulli, a CEO of SpecOps Group, a Sarasota, Florida company that sells technology under license, says, "Noise doesn't affect us and we can see through smoke. Although it can penetrate 8 inches of solid concrete, it cannot see through metal," he said. "It uses a low-powered microwave signal, about 1,000th the strength of a cell phone signal, and evolved from NASA's efforts to develop low-cost small spacecraft radios." I suppose I can take a few minutes to read a section of Motley Fool. There is a little bit here that says, "Fool's School, improve your retirement starting now. Odds are you're looking forward to retirement and are hoping it will be low stress and enjoyable. No matter your age, there are probably some steps you can take now to improve your future financial security. For starters, have a plan and be sure to follow it. Try to determine how much money you'll need to retire with and how you'll amass that money." And then it says in parentheses, "Investing regularly in a low-fee broad market index fund over many years can help you build a big nest egg. Don't be reluctant to consult a fee-only financial planning professional. Good ones know much more about retirement issues than you do, and they can save you or earn you much more than they cost. You can find a fee-only advisor near you at napfa.org. Many people find themselves bored or lonely in retirement. A part-time job or a social pastime can address those issues. A part-time job for a few years can also generate welcome income. Give some thought to jobs or activities you'd enjoy. Take a little time to learn about Social Security and think about when you'll want to start collecting your benefits. You can start as early as age 62 and as late as 70. The size of your benefit checks will depend on when you start." And again, in parentheses, "Remember that while starting earlier means smaller checks, you'll also get more of them. Learn more at ssa.gov. Don't neglect healthcare in your planning, as there's a good chance it will cost you a lot. Fidelity Investments has estimated that an average couple retiring at age 65 this year will spend a total of $300,000 out of pocket on healthcare throughout their retirement. The more you think about it and plan for your retirement, the better it's likely to be. You might look into buying an annuity, which can deliver reliable income for the rest of your life. A reverse mortgage, while not right for many people, may serve you well. You can get more retirement advice by trying our Rule Your Retirement service at fool.com/services. There's another advice top story here. It says careers advice, but maybe it can go for others as well. "Apologies that mean business. 4 tips for a sincere professional way to say I'm sorry." We're all going to screw up in one way or another at home and at work, whether we meant to or not. Stuff happens. The civilized response and solution to when we err is simple. Just say you're sorry. But don't make the mistake of giving a non-apology apology. A classic example is saying something like, "I'm sorry you felt that way," or maybe worse, "I'm sorry you got mad." These qualify as non-apologies because they convey no empathy and show no accountability to how your actions contributed to the problem. You're divorcing yourself from the situation and making it the other person's problem. When we don't take the chance to deliver a sincere apology, we miss the opportunity to heal wounds and turn around negative situations. A good apology can help us crawl out of the holes we create for ourselves. Here are 4 elements of a good apology that work in both personal and business settings. First, own the fault. The first element of a good apology is to own it. Say, "I screwed up," with no excuses like, "the dog ate my homework" or "the devil made me do it." It's also important to be specific about how you screwed up to show understanding. If you told someone you would deliver a report Friday but didn't get it to them until Tuesday, own that mistake. The second bit of advice is be empathetic. Show empathy to the person you wronged. In our example about the late report, you could apologize for putting stress on the other person waiting for the information from you, which didn't allow them to do their best work. The point here is to connect the head with the heart, the lateness of the report with the fact that it had a negative impact on your colleagues' ability to do their work and that you understand the impact. It might even help to show how you would have felt if you were them. Taking the opportunity to say you're sorry, that you apologize for what you did and the impact it had on the other person's life is just fundamental to saying you're truly sorry. The third bit of advice is no repeats. Kick off the healing with the promise to never repeat that mistake again. Even if you weaken the point by saying you'll try to never do it again, make the commitment to the person that you understand the hurt that your mistake has caused and that you are doing everything in your power to ensure that it doesn't happen again while also understanding that you might lose their trust if it does. And the final bit of advice says seal the deal. While you might be able to kiss and make up at home, you'll need to use other strategies to seal the deal of the apology with something like a fist bump, a handshake, or if you're working virtually, simply asking the other person, "Are we good now?" The idea is to close the deal in a way that allows the healing to begin. Of course, if you're the person on the other end of the apology, you also need to be willing to accept that apology, which can be difficult if you've been really hurt or if someone has made the same mistake 5 times in a row. But if you are willing, tell the person something like, "I accept your apology." You could even go further by adding, "I appreciate that you understand how you hurt me, and I am hopeful it never happens again." When you can say something like that, it really does kick off a sense of healing and gives you both the best chance to repair your relationship. I'm going to go ahead and do Dear Abby now and then finish out the last few minutes with sports. The headline on Abby today is Tears Keep Flowing Despite Life's Many Blessings. The first letter begins, "Dear Abby, I am a very fortunate 60-year-old male. I have a wonderful life, great kids, I'm a new grandfather, and I'm recently retired. I think I am a happy and overall positive person. Most people would be thrilled to have my life. However, I can't seem to stop crying. I tear up at the end of every sad or romantic movie. I choke up when I'm around my loved ones, and it is only getting worse. I wonder if it is because of pain I experienced in my past or fear about the future. Do you have any insights based on your experience?" Signed, Tearing Up in Ohio. And Abby responds, "Dear Tearing Up, the death of loved ones can make a person increasingly emotional. Being able to express emotions is a gift, not a disability. You may simply be a sensitive individual, but because you say this is, quote, only getting worse, it might benefit you to discuss what's going on with your physician or a licensed mental health professional who can put your health, put your concerns to rest." The second letter begins, "Dear Abby, my ex-girlfriend and I have been good friends for the past 5 years. Even though our relationship didn't work out, I still want to be there for her as a friend. My ex isn't that financially responsible, nor is her family, and she keeps asking me for bailouts. I have loaned her thousands of dollars since our breakup. I am of two minds about this. Part of me feels I'm being taken advantage of. However, the other part of me knows she doesn't have many friends, and because I believe in karma, I tend to help those in need. Please tell me what I should do. Should I continue helping or let her fail?" Signed, Lending a Helping Hand. And Abby responds, "Dear Lending, there is a point after which helping becomes enabling. You reached that milestone years ago. It's time to let your ex-girlfriend suffer the consequences of her financial irresponsibility so you can focus on helping people who won't take advantage of your generosity." And then the final letter begins, "Dear Abby, my husband and I used to be very close to another couple in town. Before the pandemic, they caused quite a bit of pain and drama among our friend group, so we decided to add some distance. The pandemic provided the perfect excuse. We exchange texts every few weeks, but otherwise we don't interact much. The problem is, now that we're all vaccinated, they want to be friends again, and we just aren't up for it. We don't know the best way to clearly end the friendship. How do you break up with friends?" Signed, Moved On in the Midwest. And Abby responds, "Dear Move Don, if you want to end the friendship, a way to do that would be to be busy and not available to them. If you are asked for an explanation, tell them the pandemic forced you to rethink your schedule, that you see fewer people than you did before it happened, and therefore you are no longer available to the extent that you were. It's kinder than saying you think they are troublemaking drama queens, which would be unkind and cause hurt feelings." Turning to the sports page, the headline on the weekend's Bandits game says, "Second half surge boosts Bandits to win over Omaha." This is by Shane Lance. If this was the final home game of the season for the Sioux City Bandits, it was one heck of a way to go out. If it wasn't, Sioux City fans will have plenty to be excited about in a few weeks. The Bandits scored an important victory on Saturday night at Tyson Event Center as some second-half heroics on both sides of the ball boosted Sioux City to a 35-28 win over arch-rival Omaha. The game got off to a quick start as the Bandits scored a touchdown on the fourth play of the game. Omaha quarterback Andrew Jackson threw a 20-yard pass to Anthony Jones Jr., and the Beef led the Bandits 7-0 just over a minute into the game. On the very next play, Bandits veteran returner Xavier Spann took the kickoff and ran it back 43 yards for a touchdown, tying the game at 7-7. The Beef offense managed to score three more points before the end of the quarter on a 21-yard field goal from kicker Jeremy Reynolds, and then three more at the 11:23 mark in the second, as Reynolds hit one from 20 yards. 5 minutes later, Omaha scored again as Jackson hit wide receiver Norman Darden for a 19-yard touchdown, putting Omaha up by a 20-7 score. Sioux City scored its first offensive touchdown with 2:15 left in the first half when quarterback Dylan Turner threw a 10-yard scoring pass to Braden Mintz. The PAT was no good as Tyler Stolen's kick clanked off the left upright, but Omaha's lead was trimmed to 20-13 as the teams went to halftime. Omaha outgained Sioux City in total offense in the first half, 120 yards to 49. Jackson had 117 yards through the air in the first half for Omaha, while Turner went 7 for 11 for 53 yards. On defense, Omaha held Sioux City to negative 4 yards rushing in the first two quarters while finishing with 3 tackles for loss. After a rogue point put Omaha up 21-13, Sioux City's offense finally clicked with 10:40 left in the third. Turner capped off a 6-play, 45-yard drive with a 3-yard touchdown run to pull Sioux City within 2. Bandits newcomer Tyler Knight then tackled Jackson in the end zone for a safety, tying the game at 21 at the 8:51 mark of the third period. The Beef took the lead back with a 35-yard touchdown pass to Tyler Jones at the start of the fourth quarter, but Sioux City tied it up again with 12:50 remaining. Spann broke off another big run on special teams to give the Bandits the ball at the 6-yard line. Turner trotted into the end zone on the very next play, and after the PAT, the game was tied at 28. Turner put the Bandits ahead for good with 6:10 left in the game, this time on a 1-yard touchdown run to put Sioux City up by the final score of 35-28. Spann sealed the game by intercepting Jackson in the end zone with 50 seconds remaining. Spann finished the game with 5 tackles and interception and 3 returns on special teams for 96 yards. Turner finished the night with 14 completions on 22 attempts, along with 45 rushing yards and 3 rushing touchdowns. Bandits head coach Irv Strobing said, "Dylan with the ball on the ground, that quarterback draw was really working. We struggled in the first half to run the ball, and we were kind of committed in the second half to getting some ground yardage. I think we did that." As a team, the Bandits finished with 81 rushing yards, all of which came in the second half. On defense, Knight finished with a team-high 9 tackles, including a sack and 4 tackles for loss. It was Knight's first professional game since he retired from the Sioux Falls Storm of the Indoor Football League in 2017. Knight played both linebacker and defensive end against the Beef and didn't seem to have any issues with rust after being away for over 3 years. Knight said, "Football is football. You line up and play between the lines, play between the numbers, see ball, get ball, and the most important thing is everyone doing their assignment. I know wherever I'm at, as long as I do my assignments, it's everybody doing their 1/8. We come out, play together, and put it all together, and that is what makes it a great team." With the win, Sioux City finished in third place in the regular season champions indoor football standings. The Bandits will play at Omaha in 2 weeks in the league semifinals, while first-place Salina will host fourth-place Dodge City. If Sioux City beats Omaha again and Dodge City beats Salina, Sioux City will host the league's championship game. On Saturday, after exiting a locker room pulsing with loud music and filled with exuberant Bandits, Strobeen was all smiles. He said, "It's a good way to go into the playoffs. That was the goal, to gain some momentum and get this team rolling in the right direction. We're going to play these guys again in 2 weeks, and we wanted to set the tone tonight." We're going to conclude this reading of the journal with a college baseball story from Omaha. The headline says, "No apologies from Vandy in pursuit of repeat." Awkward is the only way to describe Vanderbilt's appearance in the All-SEC College World Series Finals beginning Monday night against Mississippi State. The Commodores were supposed to play North Carolina State in a winner-take-all bracket final Saturday and found out 12 hours before the start that the Wolfpack had been removed from the tournament because of COVID-19 protocols. The game was declared a no contest. Vanderbilt coach Tim Corbin said, "We certainly sympathize with their team, their fan base too, understanding that we don't know the level of hurt that they are exposed to right now, but we certainly recognize it. None of us wish to be in this particular position. We certainly would want to play them on the field or have played them on the field, but we didn't. So we are in the situation where we move forward." Vanderbilt is the reigning national champion, having won the CWS in 2019. There was no tournament last year because of the pandemic. The number 4 national seed Commodores are at this point after winning 2 elimination games, most recently Friday against an NC State team that had only 13 players available. First baseman Dominic Keegan said, "We're here for a reason. We earned our spot here, and we got here because of our abilities and what we can do." The number 7 Mississippi State Bulldogs played 2 bracket finals against Texas, winning 4-3 on Saturday on Tanner Leggett's walk-off base hit. Mississippi State coach Chris Leminis said, "Our guys have fought since the day we got here. We haven't had an easy game yet. It's been very tight, tough ball games. But man, they keep finding a way to persevere. It's been earned by our guys, and I look forward to seeing them play on this stage." Vanderbilt won 2 of the 3 regular season meetings with Mississippi State. In Nashville in April, Vanderbilt's Kumar Rocker, a possible top 10 pick in the Major League Baseball draft and the 2019 College World Series most outstanding player, pitched a 3-hitter in the first game of that series and could be available if the finals go 3 games. Mississippi State will start Christian McLeod in Game 1. He's made 1 appearance in the College World Series, lasting just 1 1/3 innings and giving up 4 runs in a 6-5 win over Virginia. Corbin wasn't ready to announce his Monday starter. National strikeout leader Jack Leader, a projected top 5 draft pick, would be up next in the rotation. Mississippi State has begun using a back entrance to enter and leave its hotel as a precaution against COVID-19. Leminis said the move was made in response to the Wolfpack's virus issues. The Bulldogs have brought a large group of fans to Omaha and players mixed with them until Friday. Corbin said Vanderbilt has not altered its coming and going routine at its hotel. Corbin didn't answer directly when asked if he could require his players to be vaccinated because Vanderbilt is a private university. That wouldn't be the case at public schools such as NC State and Mississippi State. Corbin said, "I've spent a lot of time educating the group what this process could look like at the beginning of the year. We are certainly comfortable with where we are and what we've done." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for June 28th, Monday, June 28th. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.